This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I am Chris Spangle. To my right is Greg Lenz.
Hello, everyone.
And to my left is Gina Martinez.
Hey, guys.
A little bit of a light crew. Normally, you know, it expands up to, you know, 8 or 9 people, but it's just the three of us this
Apparently
time.
We offended some people last week.
Yep. Oh, go figure.
Yeah. Creighton. Eat it. We're just kidding. We didn't offend Creighton.
DC sellout.
Creighton is back in Washington, D.C., holed up in his little apartment, worshiping his Rand Paul poster.
Yes.
So if you see a
What's
man
happening?
Walk, yeah, if you see a man walking around Washington, D.C. with a Rand boner, that would be Creighton Harrington.
There's no way to get rid of a Rand boner.
Either. No. Only elect him president. All right. So generally, listen, we have gone... This is our 55th episode.
Wow.
And through like the first 35 or so, we'd never talked about President Obama really once. Not even when he was running for president. Just, we really never covered Obama. And we've been talking about the president a lot lately. And that's going to continue tonight. that will continue to happen.
We Are Obama Haters is the new name of the show.
No, I will say in our second topic... We will say good things about the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm.
They've actually done something right for once.
Awesome.
So
they're thinking about doing something right.
Yeah.
It isn't done yet.
Please keep listening, even though we said that we'd say something nice about the Obama administration. But first, we've got to talk about Egypt. We'll just jump. This is 2 minutes into the show, and we're starting topics. Are we feeling okay?
It's a new record.
For sure.
Yeah. Gina walked in for the first time. She was like... All right, let's everybody crack down, get on the air. Now, we're like, Gina, are you okay?
She was very dominatrix.
Yeah.
Our safe word is Filner.
That guy is creepy. Did you know much about Bob Filner from San Diego?
I didn't know who he was even really until you put that picture in chat today.
And he's just the creepiest guy ever. He's the mayor of San Diego. He's essentially a rapist. And there was a 67-year-old great-grandmother who came out today with a cane and a moo-moo. Probably
a Walmart shopper.
Yeah, probably, you know.
Oh my Lord.
Seems like a very sweet lady who said that he walked up and shoved his tongue down her throat and said, "How long do you think I can go?"
8 hours.
8 hours. And then walked away when she was in the senior citizens wing of
some hospital or community center.
Yeah,
or
like,
yeah.
Really, dude? He's a... Are you okay?
That's funny.
You should see the picture.
Oh, yes.
She is... she's a foxy lady.
Yep.
Sorry, I missed that piece of knowledge.
Oh, yes, you are.
He really is a disgusting human being, and I was glad to see that Glenn Beck's sign that he made up that said, you know, Bob Filner is not welcome in this establishment. We respect women here. And Hooters put it up in San Diego, and it made national news, so...
Good for Hooters.
Really, yeah. I totally agree. So this guy, so that's your Bob Filner update.
Aww.
We talked a lot about Wiener. We should get to the guy who really is the gross creep.
Yeah, that's, wow.
He just looks, at that new improved Joker smile.
I'll ask you this, though. The grandmother or Sidney Leathers? Pick one.
Don't make me pick.
Pick
Don't
one.
Make me pick.
Oh, yeah.
My
oh,
skin
yeah.
just crawled a little.
Like, all right, let me explain the great grandmother.
Uh-huh.
Like the 4chan picture.
Oh my.
Have you ever seen What's Eating Gilbert Grape?
Yes.
Stop. That's mean.
That's not mean. I'm just saying
it was the truth.
That's that's what the grandma looked like was the mom in there.
Seems like a very nice lady.
Yeah, she was nice.
Godly woman.
She can't look like an actress and be a nice person, Chris? Jeez.
No. No. So, I look like John Candy, and I'm not a nice person.
That's true.
All I can do is refrain here, because I know that the last great-grandmother I hung out with, who had stories of strange men coming up and kissing her, was telling a more pleasant story.
Oh, boy. Her days in the Civil War brothel.
Yes.
Okay, Egypt. Egypt is... many people predicted that trouble was coming for Egypt, and trouble is here. Here are the basics. As we all know, a couple years ago, the Arab Spring hit, and Mubarak was kicked out of office. Mubarak was essentially a dictator who led the military, and the military backed him, and he gave a lot of kickbacks to the Egyptian military. They were very comfortable. Especially because you, the American taxpayers, helped make them comfortable. People took to the streets, the Arab Spring started, they came out and overthrew Mubarak. Mubarak's dead now, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, I think he went into a coma. And so they held democratic elections for the first time in the history of Egypt. And they elected Mohamed Morsi president, and he was closely associated with the Muslim Brotherhood.
Their
leader. And the Muslim Brotherhood for a long time had a reputation of, some said they were secular, but they were also very closely tied to...
Well, their original founding was they called for the implementation of Sharia law back in the 20s when it was founded.
Right.
And they kind of got away towards more of like social welfare in order to grow their ranks, and then they've gradually gotten back to wanting more of a Sharia lifestyle.
Right. They were really sort of the beginnings of the Islamist movement that Osama bin Laden sprang from. And they were elected across the nation, and basically went on to proceed, even though they were democratically elected, they proceeded to act like Mubarak. And they acted like dictators, cracking down on dissenters, cracking down on the opposition in violent ways.
They crafted a very restrictive constitution, too. That was one of the main points of contention with the secular Egyptians.
Right. And so the Egyptian citizens, especially the Twitterati, Egypt is a more secular nation than maybe even Saudi Arabia and some of the other countries. And there were a lot of alarm bells going off in Egypt. And so a month ago now, right?
Yep.
And they overthrew the government in basically what was a coup. There are three main interests at play here. There is the Muslim Brotherhood, the military, and then basically the people.
Yeah.
The people are a large force. And the military were persuaded by the people to come in and overthrow the democratically elected government and set up a new system. Well, everything was tense because the Muslim Brotherhood and their supporters and the people that voted for them, obviously they won a democratic election, so they do have supporters in Egypt. And make up a good part of the population. And this is a country of 90 million.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very big country. Many people in Egypt were outraged that the military would overthrow them.
I mean, they probably felt a lot like Gore voters in 2000.
That's a pretty... Yeah.
You know.
Basically, that's exactly right. How they felt. This is a country that doesn't have a history of democratic transitions like America does.
Yeah.
America, Britain, the West, we have traditions of transferring power. And when things don't work, we have systems, institutions in place to help transfer out bad people and bring in good people.
Oh, yeah, like in 2000, there weren't tanks in the street when that election was still up for decision. I mean, the Supreme Court issued a ruling, and there you had it.
The rowdiest it got was some college Republicans in a voting center in Florida.
Some hanging chads.
Right. So, you know, they don't have those institutions and those... it's not that they couldn't implement those values and institutions. It's just that they don't currently exist. And so tensions have been rising, and the military has become more and more entrenched. The military is hell-bent on keeping their power and making sure that they are the most influential party within the government because they want to keep out the Islamists, and they want to keep out the Muslim Brotherhood because most of Egyptian society does not want it to become Saudi Arabia. They don't want it to become a Taliban-like state.
No, I mean, they have a lot of secular citizens, and then they have quite a few Coptic Christians. And those are who were really under attack under the Morsi regime.
So yesterday, the military, things came to a head yesterday, and 638 people, by the estimates of the military, say that 638 were killed in yesterday's protest across Egypt. And the Coptic Christians especially, people started to form human chains around some of these churches. The Coptic Christians are a sect of Christianity that are an ancient strain of Christianity. And these churches that were burned and destroyed by the Muslim Brotherhood supporters yesterday, although the Muslim Brotherhood says that the state police and the military did it because they're trying to cast all the ills in society on them.
Yeah.
These churches that burned and were gutted by fire essentially were centuries old. Very, you know, going back to the beginning of the religion.
Yeah,
the
they're from like the 500s and 600s.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was a very bad situation. You know, we tweeted out a link if there were some photos from the area if you want to see what it looked like. One of the frightening parts about what took place, they were targeting journalists. One well-known photographer, foreign correspondent, freelance videographer was killed. There were a couple of reporters. I listened to NPR earlier, and she was saying that she was targeted. Although she's Egyptian, she was able to get away and was able to find safety, but Western journalists especially were targeted. If you looked like you were a Western journalist, they were targeting you. And it wasn't the Muslim Brotherhood doing that, it was the military. And there is tension rising in Egypt between the military and foreign journalists because they're not reporting the things that the military wants them to report. So they're trying to create a culture of fear to drive Western journalists out, which is a major sign of tyranny.
Yeah.
And
shows that they could be slipping back into a tyrannical scene.
And they really always have been the strongest institution in the entire country
since
its beginning. I mean, even Mubarak, it was purely the military that he controlled, and by controlling them, he controlled the whole country.
Yeah, the military set up a government, a puppet government, and Mohammed al-Baradei, who was the atomic inspector that went into Iraq and didn't find any weapons of mass destruction.
We'll find him. We're still looking.
We're still looking. George Bush, that's what he's doing now. And he resigned shortly after the violence because he didn't know anything about it. I mean, the military went behind the government's back that they had set up to create some of this violence. So it shows that the military is acting independently of the government. And so now the people of Egypt have a choice, or maybe they don't. I mean, you essentially have the Muslim Brotherhood and the military. They elected the Muslim Brotherhood. That didn't work out. They brought in the military. That doesn't seem to be working out. They may be slipping back into a dictatorship.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who would rise though. There's no real
in the protest
populist guy.
Al-Sisi is the defense minister in Egypt, and he is the one who appointed the new government. And many of the pro-military supporters today had printed out photos of al-Sisi, and he is well-regarded. He's a General Petraeus figure.
Yeah, educated here.
Right. Pre-scandal. that is the sort of the view that many people have of al-Sisi, and he is set to become many people in the country, many commentators are saying that he's a Nasser figure, and he's the one that is set to rise.
But he's very soft-spoken. He's very quiet. He's not charismatic whatsoever. And he doesn't see, even though he has orchestrated quite a bit at this, I don't see him as a power-hungry individual, someone looking to create a nationalist Egyptian national socialist party, if you will.
Right.
He doesn't seem that type whatsoever.
There was a great story today in the National Journal by Michael Hirsch, Egypt, back to the Infantata. And I want to read a passage from it. The images in Egypt are excruciating to behold, both in a literal and philosophical sense. In what appeared to be more of a direct military assault than a police-style crowd-clearing exercise, Egyptian forces reportedly killed nearly 150 people, most of them supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi, who were engaged in nothing more offensive than a series of sit-ins. Suddenly, in one awful day, the exercise of the democratic rights and ideals that are so dear to America's self-image, and which have formed the heart of the U.S. foreign policy since the end of the Cold War, were rendered all but irrelevant to many Arabs, especially because of Washington's mild response. Apart from a few dissenters such as al-Baradei, the once-inspiring secularists who massed in Tahrir Square to oust Hosni Mubarak, have now repudiated those democratic rights and values by continuing to support the bloody crackdown. And while the Obama administration issued a rote condemnation, the lack of any more dramatic response continues to fritter away what little moral authority America has left. So Obama came out today, interrupted his vacation on Martha's Vineyard to come out.
The Vineyard.
Yeah, to issue an audio-only statement on this. And he made a big announcement that he was canceling the exercises that we have yearly with the Egyptian military, even though we've not had those exercises since 2009, I think.
Yeah.
2011. But we haven't had them in the last few years. And he did not announce a withdrawal of financial aid, which comes to $1.5 billion to the Egyptian military. The reason we give them financial aid is twofold. We want to maintain influence and leverage in a country that is essential in protecting Israel and maintaining peace and stability in the region. And also that $1.5 billion we basically put into a bank account in New York City for the Egyptians. And then that money is spent on American defense companies that produce the goods for the Egyptians and ship it over. So
it's a stimulus package.
It's great right. for congressmen who are wanting to get reelected, because that $1.5 billion, that keeps jobs in their district.
Yeah.
So that's one reason why Rand Paul's sentiment today of transferring that $1.5 billion to America and rebuilding roads and bridges here, answering the question of who will build the roads, was soundly defeated in the Senate. So, you know, let's talk about, and he was also very careful not to say that it's a coup.
Yeah.
Because if it's a coup, that means by law we have to stop aid. So, Greg, let's ask you first and then Gina.
Right.
Do you believe that financial aid should be stopped to Egypt?
I do. I do. I think it doesn't matter if we send aid or not. They still have $12 billion annually coming in from Saudi Arabia, the UAE, various other Middle Eastern countries. So as far as their military goes, they're still well-financed and well-funded. Chuck Hagel actually reached out to Sisi and told him specifically we would recommend you not do this. And he still carried forward and ignored him. So to say that there's a relationship there and that we have an element of control is probably an overestimation by any foreign policy expert. I mean, for us, there was a great UK Telegraph article today saying the Western world really just has to let Egypt sort this out. We don't have a dog in the fight. He was a foreign policy expert, and he said in Egypt, the historic history says there are autocrats and theocrats, and all you can do is pick one side and hope they win. And that's not a good pick at all. I say just why have a dog in the fight?
Yeah, I agree that we should stop aid primarily because it's obviously a coup. I mean, we can call it whatever we like, but it's clearly a coup, a military coup, basically a textbook military coup. And so just by our own standards, we should have stopped aid. And you're right, it's completely volatile. Who knows which direction it's going to go? I mean, it's great that we're moving the money and that there are jobs staying in, you know, certain districts here domestically. However,
you can spend it elsewhere, you know.
Yeah, and if we're putting arms in the hands of individuals that we know are in a volatile situation, how smart are we? It's like handing a toddler a loaded weapon and getting pissed when you lose an eye.
We do that quite often. Yeah.
So I totally agree with both of you, especially Greg. I mean, the wealthy oil-rich nations that we continue to fund with our high gas prices will fill that vacuum if we're not there. But let me play devil's advocate to either one of you that wants to tackle it first. That would give up whatever remaining leverage we have in Egypt. That leverage, don't you feel that's important, especially in a country that is or once was a stabilizing force in the region? And if we remove our leverage, if we remove our influence, and we end up with an Islamic dictatorship there, isn't that bad for our interest in a country where one-tenth of the world's goods flow through the Suez Canal?
I mean, we're America. Let them get their shit together, and then we'll address whomever is in power. They're going to need our assistance. They're going to need to... I mean, if one-tenth of the goods are coming through there, a great deal of the goods are coming to our shores. They have a vested interest in wanting to cooperate. I mean, we have a vested interest in wanting to cooperate with them once they get their shit together.
Can they?
get together?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's time. Only time will tell. It depends on how many more military coups they come up with. It depends on how many more.
Let me ask you this as a woman. Would you rather live under a theocratic state where you're regarded as less, or an autocratic state where it's secular?
I would go full-blown Maya on that one. I would go full-blown anarchist.
No, I agree, obviously. But when the reality is, those are your options. There is no anarchy option.
No, for real, I would be heading out like it was the next Holocaust. Oh, yeah.
Smart decision.
Right, and that's what's happening in Syria. And there are people who feel that if this situation is not stabilized, it descends into a serious situation. Lebanon came out today and said that Jordan came out today and said that they are overwhelmed with Syrian refugees.
And Beirut just had a huge car bomb explosion today. I think that's the next one.
Yep. And Iraq, violence is increasing there.
People are starting to identify that as the Islamic Republic of Iraq. That is a
really
growing movement within Iraq.
So I really feel that, you know, despite my devil's advocate question, and I'll let you answer the question before I do. All right, never mind. I feel that getting rid of our leverage there doesn't really matter. We clearly, with $1.5 billion in influence, we're not having any influence anyways. We have totally mismanaged any kind of response. When Barack Obama comes out and says something, or when the spokesman for the State Department reads something from John Kerry, I think the world rolls their eyes. I don't think we have any leverage left. I think that Barack Obama, when you look at the effigies that are being burned, and hey, isn't it weird, Greg, that all these effigies that are being burned of Obama in Egypt aren't being shown on TV like the effigies of Bush that were burned in Iraq?
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
Oh, yeah. That's shocking, actually.
And it's because he backed the Mubarak. It's sort of been...
He gave a great speech, and it was sincere and earnest about rebuilding the relationship with the Muslim world, and then he backs Hosni Mubarak.
Right.
But then at the same time, he's in a tough position. Realistically, you keep the slush fund to buy whatever loyalty you can, just to be pragmatic. Whether it has any influence, who knows? But you can't just stand back. Even that's probably the right thing to do. As a world leader, you can't just sit there on the sidelines and watch.
But isn't that exactly what he's done?
No, because what the military is doing is going to be stable. The Muslim Brotherhood essentially complied with our request. The Muslim Brotherhood is a transnational Islamic organization that wants to install a caliphate long term of Arab states. That has been their goal since their founding. It'd be like having a transnational Republican Party where Canada, Mexico, the Republicans would be in every parliament and every government. That is the long term. That is their long term framework. Ultimately, who knows if it's a good or bad thing? But when we talk with them and communicate, we say, "Fine, if that's your goal, whatever. Do it democratically." They did.
Ouch.
That got overthrown. They always said is they hate how democracy has been Western culture infiltrating their culture,
mm-hmm.
but yet they complied and went that route and won. And then they got overthrown by the military, who has close ties with the U.S. government. They're making a strong case that maybe democracy isn't meant for their vision, and so why should they pursue it?
I think there's a large segment of their population that might feel that way, but there also is, and maybe it's a vocal minority, especially of the young Egyptians, the so-called Twitterati in Tahrir Square that helped lead the revolution, I don't think they feel that way, you know?
How do you identify them, though? Like, if the secularists are a huge part of the population that overthrew Morsi, how do you identify them and help them take control? Eventually, you have to stand up and assume control. The problem is there's in their elite ruling class are the military people and the theocrats.
Well, part of the, you know...
There are no secular
leaders. El-Baradei is the perfect poster child for their movement. Here's a guy who is very well respected, clearly has a moral compass. So when he says, "I'm not going to stand with a government that just mows people down," he's Western educated. He is a secularist. He has zero power and influence.
Mm-mm.
He has respect, but that doesn't necessarily translate into power in this vacuum. And so, you know, sometimes the good guys finish last because of the stronger, more violent elements of a society.
And that's when the president, even though his message was very innocuous and very neutral, he did nail it when he said the Egyptian people have to settle this. And it means the secularists have to assume power and say that we are the majority and we will not tolerate a dictator and a military dictatorship, and we will not tolerate a theocracy. But until they do it, they're going to be ruled.
Yeah, I don't think we can have any effect there. I don't think we can have any influence there anymore. And I just don't think we should send more weapons when we know we're just basically funding death.
Yeah.
So I think we should just say
but
no.
But weapons by design are funding death.
Yeah.
Right. So Congress should man up and cancel the contracts and take the hit.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and stop building a military-industrial complex that basically, you know, here in America, building tanks doesn't mean anything. I mean, tanks are not going to roll up here into Polo Run and
unless fire. It's Boston suddenly, and then they just might. They might roll right on up from, from Atterbury.
We don't need tanks to take out mittens sitting in the window. I mean, but they do use them in Egypt. And part of it, too, is the Muslim Brotherhood. If you watched some of the footage, if you watched Al Jazeera today or yesterday, if you watched some of the news sources that actually can get in there and cover the story from all angles, the Muslim Brotherhood, it's very reminiscent of the Israeli and the Palestinians. The military has military-grade weapons and probably always will, and then the Muslim Brotherhood supporters had rocks.
Yep.
You know, so I think if you're sitting there saying, well, yes, a military that has a financial interest in stabilizing the Suez Canal is better for American interests than an Islamic government that wants to harm our interests, it's probably going to tip in our favor just by virtue of the weapons.
And that's what our foreign policy has become, interests over values.
So what happens if something like Syria takes place, where basically the entire Middle East is a proxy war between Iran and Russia versus the United States?
Mm-hmm. Well, Iran and Russia are, they don't care who wins. They want cheap oil from Iran, and they'll do deals with bad people. They're totally valueless. For us, we like to think that we promote democracy, freedom, blah blah blah, and yet we get egg on our face because we look like we don't care about that at all anymore. Mm-hmm. And why are we doing something that's going to specifically pit us against Iran and Russia? All it makes us look like is we're trying to revive the Cold War.
Right.
I agree.
It doesn't make any sense at all from a foreign policy perspective, but you do eventually have to deal with it. Because if the Muslim Brotherhood spreads and it is a true democratic movement, or at least a movement of widespread adoption, you are facing a united Arab states in the Middle East, and you talk about much more difficult to deal with than a military dictatorship in Egypt. Mm-hmm. One
united state, one caliphate, yep, like the Ottoman Empire.
You think it's hard to spread civil liberties now? Wait till you're dealing with that.
Yeah. Well, clearly what we've tried to do over the last 10 years, or really since Reagan on, hasn't worked. Intervention, clearly, at this point, can we say that intervention in the Middle East and really, you know, elsewhere has not worked for the Americans' interests?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, you can recognize it every time one of our own, you know, one of something that we funded, a weapon that we delivered, is used against us when we go. I mean, but we are marching into war over there. So,
but what really has worked has been our economic system. You know, China, Taiwan, yeah, Hong Kong, Korea, or sorry, South Korea. I mean, these are all booming Asian tiger economies built on capitalism principles, and now they've surpassed us in economic freedom. That's right. The approach.
Yeah.
That is what will unite a citizenry and get the crazies out.
Yeah, clearly intervention hasn't worked. I want to read another passage from this National Journal story because I want to ask the question about our foreign policy or the Obama administration's foreign policy. As it has for the last 2 years, the Obama administration is still struggling with the appropriate response. But the perception abroad is that the administration has vacillated without any coherent policy. Initially, during the Arab Spring, the administration defended its old autocratic allies, such as Egypt's Hosni Mubarak and Yemen's Ali Saleh. Then it moved to championing the young secularists in the street with the hopes of a liberal democracy that now look as naive as the visions of the George W. Bush-era neoconservatives. After the election of Morsi, the administration lurched in yet another direction, embracing the Islamist president and the Muslim Brotherhood, even to the exclusion of the secularists. And when Morsi was ousted on July 3rd, the administration avoided calling it a coup so as not to jeopardize its aid relationship with the Egyptian military. So the Obama administration, like many things, is just sort of disinterested. It's a little all over the map.
But isn't that the response you would want from a libertarian?
And that's my question. Do you fault the Obama administration for being lackadaisical in its approach to some of these monumentous, you know, do you feel that Obama has just basically gone with the flow, letting the nations decide for themselves, or should he get his head in the game and stand by principles and values?
If you're standing by principles and values, there has to be someone to support, and you have to be able to identify them. And I don't, and you have to do it financially and through military help, but it's almost, how do you identify secularists when they're under the threat? They know if they
identify
lose, they're
themselves,
dead,
yeah.
You know, and
right.
And they don't organize, and they, you know, you don't stand up and organize around, we're the middle road, you know, non-crazy, it's come to this meeting on XYZ, you know, it just doesn't happen.
Right.
And that's the hard part for the president. So he's showing, what we're seeing is a little bit of isolationist policy in real time.
Whoa, non-interventionist.
That's not isolationist.
We don't use the I word here on We Are Libertarians.
Yeah. I don't think it's a bad word.
No. I mean, it's just different. I mean, the non-interventionist approach has clearly been proven right. You know, I think it's trying to interfere. What statements Obama has made have backfired on him. What aid he has given just makes one side mad or the other side mad, and it just doesn't really, you know, he hasn't, you know, maybe Rand Paul, if he were president, who I believe has a mostly non-interventionist foreign policy outlook, I don't think he may be as solid as his dad, but he certainly is more isolationist than Obama. When he does intervene, he mucks it up, you know. That was muck.
Well done.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That was muck. Muck.
Has anyone cursed?
I have.
Yeah, like three times.
Have you really?
In a span of one
minute. I'm immune to her cussing now.
Right.
I just expect it.
So, you know, if you're a libertarian president, I mean, how do you handle a situation like this?
You do what the president's doing.
I say you do less than the president is doing.
So you don't even issue a statement.
It's hot.
So it's like you're the Swiss and... What do you mean Jews are being burned? What are you talking about? Come have some hot chocolate.
Come on, that's unfair.
No, I'm just saying, though. But
you got to go to the Holocaust.
I know, I'm saying.
I mean,
good
come
example,
on.
Greg.
Yeah.
I know. But you know, you get the principle I'm saying. And that's
right.
Where I find a little bit of the libertarian belief conflicting in that. You guys are, I mean, we, because I feel I am now, I am more a little bit of conservative sometimes. But
right.
We're so principled.
Especially when it comes to the difference,
yeah.
Right, Greg?
Yep. I hate diversity. we're so principled, and everything is well reasoned out. And yet, when it comes to something like this, it's non-interventionism. When, to me, the logical extension of libertarianism is if someone wants freedom, to be there in support of them. So if someone wants to spread civil liberties like that secularist movement in Egypt, we have to be there if we truly want to live out the values that we stand for.
Stand
instead
by
of saying, nope,
yeah.
Sorry, we got ours, you got to go get yours on your own. We
right.
can't risk putting ourselves out there.
But that didn't really work.
It didn't, but I know that. It
so
didn't
I think
work
what you're
Iraq.
Saying is we can't fault for what we've done so far?
No, you guys aren't to blame at all.
Okay.
We
well,
aren't to blame.
Gina is.
Well, Gina's always to blame.
It's my fault.
She used to be a Democrat.
Most
they were
the,
always to blame.
Most of the Middle East drama is my fault.
Yes.
You drop story time with Gina in the middle of Saudi Arabia, and everything goes
boom
crazy.
Yeah, suddenly, there's problems.
Right.
But like in Iraq, there was no one to really build a secularist democracy. You know,
right.
It has to be the right situation where I would say libertarian foreign policy would be to actually intervene in Egypt. Unless the secularist groups are going to rise and stand up and say, we need help, you sit back. And that's kind of what the president's doing.
I don't think that's by design, though. I think it's just his character. Like, Barack Obama to me, and it was exemplified by the Reggie Love comment this week that he was playing cards during the Osama bin Laden raid. You know, he really strikes me as a president that just hates his job. Like, he has all the hallmarks of a guy who doesn't want to go to work anymore.
Yeah.
Like, you know that when you really hate your job, you have a desk job and you just hate it and you sit there and you just, like, browse the internet and Facebook and play games on your computer.
I mean, it's
waiting for 5
term,
o'clock to hit.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, he's not going to be able to get anything done anyway.
He's like,
plus, there was that whole NSA thing. It didn't go down real well.
Right.
Yeah.
So he just seems totally disinterested. I mean, the fact that he is, Reggie Love, his former body man who, you know, basically was his assistant through the campaign in the first term, came out and said in an interview that they were playing cards. They were playing 15 games of, what was it?
I'm not even sure.
Gin Rummy, let's say. I don't remember what the card game was, but, you know, the average time is like 20 minutes for a game, and they played 15 rounds, which comes out to like 5 hours of playing cards.
And now there's a Republican guy spreading a conspiracy that the president was photoshopped in that picture of the bin Laden raid. And I looked at it, and I was like, God, you could probably pull it off, because he was all the way in the corner of the room off by himself. And I was like, that's not bad. I mean, for conspiracy theories, it's got some street cred.
No, I don't know. I mean, I think he was in the room. But, you know, you have soldiers in a very, very dangerous situation, and every second is critical when you're in that situation. And if they need to get the president's authorization for something, they've got to come find you. You know, you're up in the White House. You're not in the Situation Room or down the hall. You're up in the dining room of the West Wing playing cards with your photographer and your body man.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Petraeus. I got to go fish real quick.
Right.
No, I said good for him.
Why?
Give that man 5 hours to play cards. That's his eighth. I mean,
no, during the raid.
During the Osama bin Laden raid into Pakistan, when he had SEAL Team 6 flying in a helicopter.
He illegally occupied a country.
Right. And he's playing cards like it's not mattering. I'll give you the vacation stuff.
It'd be like if the Chinese came into Indianapolis and, I don't know, captured some high-level target and then flew right back out.
Right.
Well, I mean, if I'm half a planet away and all I can do is sit and wait and listen, I might dick around.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that you would care so much about the outcome that you would just sit there and be...
Don't you think you'd drive yourself crazy if you didn't find some kind of busy work to do to keep your mind occupied?
I would be worried about the perception that it would come out that I was playing cards and would seem aloof and non-caring.
Politics
is the art of perception. He doesn't play that well sometimes.
Yeah, I always thought it was very odd that he wasn't sitting on the command seat in the Situation Room. That he was sitting on a little card chair.
I mean, see, I respect him more not for going for the picture.
Yeah. That's totally justified. I mean, everybody's got a different opinion on that.
He's got, I'm not quite sure who is in the photo, but it is one of their military generals sitting in his seat in the Situation Room.
Standing up.
Straight ahead, all around, the seat is built for the president, so they have all the data directly in front of them in that seat, and he is not sitting in that seat. He's not in control of the situation.
He's off in the corner.
In the photo. He's just kind of sitting there. Everybody else has a computer in front of them gathering data, and he doesn't. He's just sitting there.
And for all we know, he could have just gotten up and gone over to take a break or sit in some, you know, who knows.
Exactly right. But you'd think that they would have had a better photo.
They would have released a different picture.
Right. I mean, but his photographer was with him while they were playing Gin Rummy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it just really, I have felt all along that Barack Obama just seems disinterested in his job.
Sad.
I feel like he came in with a lot of enthusiasm, but Washington will beat every ounce of idealism out of your body.
Right.
I believe that.
Yeah, I mean, he came in thinking he could reach people with reason and get above the fray, and all of a sudden he ran into Frank Underwood types.
Yep.
And there is no getting away from that.
I truly believe that. I don't believe that he was a liar during the campaign. I believe he thought that he is so exceptional at everything that he was going to come in and change the way Washington worked.
Well, he's never failed in his whole life.
Right.
Never failed.
Nope.
And he's one of those, he's like that A kid that goes to college, he's gotten straight A's, all of a sudden they get a B on a test and they flunk out of school.
Right.
You know, it is, they can't handle it. I don't know if he's that bad, but I don't know that he could handle losing like he has. It's really affected him.
Before we move on to the next topic, can we talk about what a boob John Kerry is?
Yes.
John Kerry.
The haughty John Kerry.
It's so arrogant to me, his new peace plan. Like, here's a guy who has the Middle East, it's on fire. You know, you've got Edward Snowden in Russia. You've got these diplomatic crises around the world. You've got debt that pisses off China. And you just know that John Kerry sits there and he said, you know, if I could just get a crack at the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, I'm the one who could fix it. So I don't care if everything in the world is on fire. I'm going to fix the Israeli-Palestinian problem. You know, and it's like, that's why he wanted to be, it just makes so much sense why he wanted to be Secretary of State so bad.
But he,
over Clinton.
He is not a guy that has ever had a lot of political contact, especially global political contacts.
Right.
I mean, he's not well respected by any means. I think, quite frankly, most of his career has been because he led the, you know, the Vietnam resistance.
Right.
And then he married the Hines woman. I mean, that kind of catapulted him.
Right. Yeah, I just feel like, why are we doing this again? And Barack Obama seems totally disinterested in this, too. It's like Kerry sat down and said, all right, I'll be Secretary of State, but I want a chance to bring peace to the Middle East.
Yeah.
He, you know,
he wants to get himself in the 2016 discussion, even though his political career is done.
He just has, it's just, again, it's the old way of thinking about politics and about everything. You know, it's, well, if we can just solve the Middle Eastern peace process between these two warring groups when everything in the entire Middle East is on fire. Everybody's warring with everybody. You know, it's not just Hamas and Hezbollah hate the Israelis anymore. It's a very complicated problem, and you, John Kerry, cannot fix it.
Yeah, since the founding of our modern calendar, this has been going on.
Right.
And we've just been waiting for John Kerry to come in on his yacht, probably in a little sailor hat with a cardigan on, and broker Middle East peace.
I buy it.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Yeah. Have you thought about what you think the outcome will be? Have you guys thought about that at all in Egypt? Or how you bring it about?
I don't want to go all...
Yeah.
I don't want to go all doom and gloom here. Gina, you go first.
Well, I hate to speculate, because one day, you know, they'll get somebody democratically elected. The next day, the military will take him out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm going to go ahead and say that whatever the biggest weapons in Egypt right now say is going to happen.
So the military wins?
Assuming that somebody doesn't intervene, that's the way it's looking now.
Who would be that third party player that might come in and help support the Muslim Brotherhood?
Iran, the Saudis. I mean,
if Iran does it, though, they'd have to do it through Russia. Otherwise, everyone would know.
Man, I hate to do this, but I'm going to invoke Glenn Beck.
Uh-oh.
Okay. You know, Glenn Beck.
Hold on, let me get out my tinfoil hat.
Right. Glenn Beck always takes every, you know, I listen to him because, you know, I listen to Rush Limbaugh because I want to know what Republicans are going to think for the rest of the day. I listen to Glenn Beck because he actually does make me think, even if I don't agree with him. And his theorem is that, and he said for a long time and been mocked for it, that a caliphate is coming. And that there would be a moment when World War III would be sparked, and it'd be a little thing that nobody would really notice, much like Archduke Ferdinand being assassinated, and it just led to global catastrophe.
Triggered all the treaties.
Yeah, I mean, nobody ever really thought about that moment. It wasn't a big deal, and then, like, a year later, everybody's engaged in World War One, and he says that the fruit vendor who lit himself in fire in Tunisia that lit off the Arab Spring was the catalyst for World War III.
Wow.
Now, I'm not saying I agree with this, but I think it's a perspective
it's valid, though.
It's a theory and a perspective that I think people ought to hear just in case it comes true. When you've got the global financial pressures that we have, you have the Hindenburg omen being flashed in our markets that signal another crash. And another crash would cripple the global economy, and it'd be very, very dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, when you want to talk about trust, the whole system, a whole global economic system, the American dollar is the lifeblood of the global economic system. And it's built on trust. Trust that the United States of America is truthful, that it can dig itself out of its hole.
It will always be there.
In a totally unrelated story, Greg and Gina, the debt clock has not moved in the past month because we're a few billion away from hitting the debt ceiling limit. So Jack Lew has taken extreme measures to make sure that we don't go illegally go over the debt limit, so we don't spend more than we bring in. And by extreme measure, he means lying on the government form. And the debt clock has not moved an inch, not $1, in the last month.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I know. So even though we're, I think the what it should be is $187 billion increase.
Right.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And it just hasn't moved. So you've got that lack of trust. And then you've got this situation where you have these proxy wars going on where the entire Middle East could become Syria. And you've got proxy wars between Russia and Iran partnered together against the United States. And then China is a player waiting just to pick up the pieces for everyone and with their resources. So
they're the agnostic opportunist. They don't care who wins. It's they will come in, forge an arrangement, and get cheap resources from somewhere.
So the more optimistic view, I would say, is that not global doom in World War III between Russia and Iran and the United States, with China playing around in the middle. The optimist view is that the military just becomes a dictatorship, stabilizes Egypt, and it becomes much like Hosni Mubarak, and that flash of independence that the seculars had there in Egypt is a great memory for many people that they can hold on to generations while they are oppressed by the military government. They stabilize it. They stabilize the region as a result, and everything goes on as normal. And yes, John Kerry doesn't even get his peace between Israel and Palestine.
His yacht stays illegally parked in Rhode Island instead of Connecticut.
So I think that is probably the more likely scenario, but I do think that it's such an interesting point, that Archduke Franz Ferdinand moment and the fruit vendor in the middle of Tunisia.
And and that was his protest was purely over... Because I'm not actually not familiar with that.
There was a local government official in Tunisia who was bullying and demanding bribes of all the vendors. And the fruit vendor said, I already pay too much. I already am. You can't get blood from a turnip. Okay. I'm at my breaking point. I cannot take this anymore. And lit himself on fire.
Uh-huh.
And that. Protest that's against local government corruption lit the entire Middle East on fire.
Right. Wow. That's funny. You say that because I had just read an economic paper that essentially blamed the Arab Spring on Bernanke for all his quantitative easing since we are the foundational currency.
Was that Lou Rockwell?
No, it wasn't actually. It was someone from the Hoover Institute. And because we increased our money supply so much, it made food more expensive in the Middle East, since that's really they don't have much discretionary income. It made food prices so expensive in Egypt, it set off the protests because the government couldn't keep subsidizing the food for the citizens and gas.
I would say they're both exactly right. I would say that our dollar affected
the world,
right? And so that would prompt the government official to want extra money. That would prompt the rest of the country to be in a state of unrest, where that once this guy did take the final step and light himself on fire, everybody responded
because
they were feeling the same kind of
squeeze.
Crunch. Yeah.
When people are hungry and desperate, that's when things change.
And I would just like to say how right Suzanne Schaefer and I were when we said that economics is the foundation of everything. Then I thank you for pointing that out, Chris.
Yeah. Whatever. We'll talk about that some other time.
I'm just kidding.
Economics is not the foundation of everything, but maybe the foundation of everything related to government.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay.
You're being a dick.
I was being facetious, not being a dick.
Lies.
I was trying to give props out to Suzanne. You know, she came on the show twice, and
honey,
I usually like to mock her.
Stop agreeing with Greg. You're
That's
my
right.
wife.
Yes, keep agreeing with me.
So, yes, if you can hear that in the background, that's my wife making things in the microwave and doing dishes. So we're just in the middle of a podcast here, honey. We'll have a pep talk later. Okay, so on to the next topic. So that is your daily dose of doom and gloom, courtesy of Weird Libertarians.
Did you want to hear my humorous solution?
Yeah.
For all of Egypt?
Yes.
I thought of this on the way down, is what we'll do.
If it involves pyramids, I'm going to be very happy.
It is. It's probably a little inflammatory, but that's to be expected. It's coming from me.
Does it deal with the Bengals?
No, it deals with the end of time.
Okay.
So listen, the economy's bad in Egypt, mm-hmm. so we're going to brand this as like the Hunger Games, but it'll be like the Armageddon Games. We're going to get the Muslim population of Egypt, the Christian population of Egypt, and then the secularists. We're going to get them all in this big arena. We're going to sell tickets, TV rights, the whole shebang. Tourism will flock in. We're going to have the Muslims pray. We're going to have the Christians pray. If Jesus speaks to the Muslims and says, "I want a caliphate," then they win and they get to put Morsi back in.
Jesus probably wouldn't be the one to make the call.
No,
he
actually does. In Islamic eschatology, mm-hmm. Jesus comes back.
Yep.
Okay.
So then, if he comes back, then he speaks Aramaic and speaks to the Christians, then they get to establish a Christian theocratic state. If everybody watching all over the world and no one speaks from the sky, the secularists win and they get to set up the government and take control and everybody else to go away. Doesn't this sound perfect?
It sounds like a Japanese game show.
Yeah, but I mean, what are the likelihood someone's going to speak from the sky and say that I was right, or, you know, they were right?
I have faith in my Jesus.
If I were a secularist, I'd take the deal. We'll set up
the
TV networks.
The should take the deal, but then a religious person would turn around and say, you know, that's...
Well, then they wouldn't have faith.
I would
question their entire faith right on them.
On God to jump to the hoop.
Yeah, are you saying you don't believe that your Savior will come back in your time of need and establish what his will is on earth? You better take the deal, or else you're probably not a true believer. I would totally taunt and troll him.
I mean, you're a damn good salesman, but I could see the valid...
We can't even get these people to work together, let alone all come together and pray next to each other.
I mean, I'm just saying. Just, hey, you know, when push comes to shove, you better show up. Force their hand.
Oh, well, I think Pat Robertson loves this idea.
Oh, definitely.
He's so into it.
Oh, we could just market the hell out of this. We'll have a 1-year ceasefire. We'll have a technocratic government. It'll be great.
So we should put a poll on the Facebook page. Is Greg's idea valid?
And hey, Facebook, can we reassign problems in the Middle East? Yeah. Here's a poll.
Yes. Let's outsource Middle East peace to Facebook polls. Yes. That would be excellent.
And thank you, Gina, for yawning in the middle of our podcast.
Yeah.
Anytime.
All right. So let's give a little bit of props to the Obama administration. We've already said they're doing a good job in the Middle East, which Sean Hannity vehemently disagrees with you. And so does Charles Krauthammer, by the way, who said, yeah, Obama is bad at interventionism.
You know, he's a Canadian, though. So everything, yeah, Krauthammer says, I take with a grain of salt.
I thought he was a German.
No, he's actually Canadian.
So I thought he was the meat hammer. Isn't that what Krauthammer means?
I don't know. It sounds racist either way. Melissa Harris Perry would not be happy with
that.
That
was actually
now
my porno name in college.
The meat hammer.
The meat hammer.
Is, okay, that with the poonhound glasses?
Yes.
Yeah.
So we've already said that Barack Obama's bad at interventionism, like Charles Krauthammer. Now we're going to praise Eric Holder, who I think will go down. I think it's a real tough contest between Ashcroft, Gonzalez, and Eric Holder for the worst attorney general of all time.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you have Ashcroft, who helped devise the Patriot Act and build Homeland Security, and Gonzalez with all of his ethical lapses and the disaster that he was. And, you know,
they are all attorneys. I mean,
yeah,
what do you expect?
Exactly. If you're an attorney, move to Canada. We don't want your kind
yes,
around here anymore.
We will outsource our attorney jobs to Canada.
Yeah. And so Holder has just been a disaster on everything but what he announced this week, which is the instructing of federal prosecutors to start to basically ignore mandatory minimums, which we believe is a good idea on this program. Greg, can you explain mandatory minimums and why we believe it is a good idea?
We don't believe mandatory minimums are a good idea. We believe getting rid of them are a great idea.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah, okay. I mean, no, I'm just saying that all it does is take someone that's really not much of a criminal and turn them into a hardened criminal by putting them into prison for a victimless crime. Is that a good summary? Because that's all I feel like it really is.
Yeah, it's basically the shifting of the sentencing from the judge to the prosecutor.
Yep.
And so it's usually dealing in drugs more than anything. You know, things like the death penalty are outlawed. You can't have that. Can't be a mandatory minimum. The
3 years for your second offense for a Schedule II narco, you know.
Right. You have a certain gram percentage mm-hmm. of this drug, and you go to jail for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about a few of the examples of what mandatory minimums end up achieving. And so what it really does is it gives the prosecutor the ability to to sentence a person, because then the jury and the judge have to decide whether or not they meet those charges. The judge doesn't get to sentence. And the problem with that is that a prosecutor is part of the executive branch. Our Constitution and our entire judicial system is based on judges adjudicating sentences. So after a case is heard and they oversee the process of the trial, then they are the ones who sentence based on the situation. And it was not meant to be one size fits all. Well, what mandatory minimums do is it is one size fits all, which libertarians abhor because we're individualists. We believe in individual rights and individualism, and not every situation is exactly the same. And so prosecutors who generally try to run for a higher office and want to look tough on crime, so they can then say, well, I was tough on crime, so I should be mayor.
Yeah.
Just like here in Indianapolis.
I had a 99% conviction rate.
Right.
You'll be safe in my county.
So they pile on the charges so they can make sure that they get a conviction. You saw it with George Zimmerman. And you saw it with the George Zimmerman trial. What they did is they piled on a bunch of charges to make sure that one stuck. And, well, that backfired on them, didn't it, Gina?
Yep.
So let's talk about a few of the examples.
There is something interesting there, that libertarians don't believe in blind justice then, because mandatory minimums take the story out of the crime. So you wouldn't be supporters of just blind blanket justice, equally distributed.
I don't think that there is justice in
so it's an unjust
blind
law.
Distribution.
Oh, even blind distribution of the law.
No, the law can be applied blindly.
Mm-hmm.
But the law as it exists, the minimums, the mandatory minimums, are an unjust law.
Unjust law, gotcha.
So, like, for example, let's say you and I are both caught shoplifting.
Mm-hmm.
You're caught shoplifting with $700 in your back pocket. I'm caught shoplifting with 3 hungry children and not a penny to my name. Your crime could, in my mind, feasibly carry a higher
heinous
penalty than my own. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, totally.
I mean, 3 strikes and you're out. It's been shown that when a person commits a crime, they are more worried about the conviction than they are the sentence.
Yeah.
Once they're convicted of the crime and they're felons, that's what deters crime. It's not the length of the sentence. You know, so here are a few examples. This is from Think Progress. This is how out of whack this show's gotten. This is from Think Progress, and it is by Nicole Flatow, meet 5 people serving draconian drug sentences thanks to mandatory minimum laws. I'm not going to read all of them, but I'm going to read one or two here. The man who sold his own pain pills to an informant. John Horner had no record of drug dealing when he was sentenced to a 25-year mandatory minimum prison term for selling some of his own pain pills to an undercover informant who befriended him and told him he could not afford both his rent and his prescription medication. Horner was a fast food restaurant worker and a father, and had been prescribed the pain medication because of an injury in which he lost an eye. If, as expected, he serves all 25 years, Horner will be 72 when he is released, and he will have spent more time in prison than the former Enron CEO, Think Progress, by the way, who was convicted.
Social justice, social justice, social justice.
In one of the largest corporate fraud schemes in modern history. In the vicious cycle of snitches and informants that plagues the criminal justice system, it was another individual trying to mitigate his own sentence who lured Horner into a drug deal by first befriending him and then appealing to his generosity.
Wow.
So, you know, let's... the medical marijuana grower. Chris Williams was running a Montana medical marijuana dispensary that was considered a model of compliance with state law when his dispensary was raided by federal agents. Unlike his fellow dispensary owners, Williams did not take a plea deal, determined to take his case to trial. The very lowest mandatory minimum drug sentence was 5 years in jail, but these sentences can quickly ratchet up when other factors come into play. In Williams' case, because he kept a gun on the premises, oh no, prosecutors were able to charge Williams with 4 counts of possessing a firearm and furtherance of drug trafficking.
Damn.
Drug trafficking?
And he faced a sum total mandatory minimum sentence of 85 years.
Whoa.
Williams was found guilty for distributing a drug that remains federally illegal but was legal in Montana at the time. But in a rare move, U.S. District Court Judge Dana Christensen urged parties to reach a post-conviction plea deal to avert the 85-year sentence. Prosecutors agreed to drop all the gun charges, leaving Williams with a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence that he accepted in the hopes of seeing his 16-year-old son's college graduation. As Christensen doled out the lowest sentence he could, 5 years, he lamented that even after his intervention, the prison term was unfair and absurd. This is the judge. While many other dispensary owners have brokered plea deals, others who have gone to trial face mandatory minimums of 10 years. During his remarks Monday, Holder said nothing about whether the federal government will alter its policy of selectively prosecuting state-compliant medical marijuana dispensaries. They also talk about there was one case where they it's just outrageous. He was a low-level dealer who was arranging a meeting for $1,500 between drug dealers and had the book thrown at him because the other two got off on a technicality because they could afford better lawyers. And he's in jail for the rest of his life for arranging a meeting. And Aaron has twice appealed to the federal sentence shortened through the presidential pardon power to commute unjust sentences. But he and countless others have had their petitions denied, in part because his application was mishandled by the Obama administration, which has used its federal clemency power less often than any other president in modern history.
That's what stuns me.
Me too.
I would just be pardoning everybody. Oh my God. And yeah. If Congress didn't do what I wanted, okay, I'm pardoning all the American citizens for not paying their taxes until I get what I want.
We have 5% of the world's population, and we have 25% of the prison populations. In a USA Today editorial, the USA Today has been a voice for mandatory minimums over the years. And they came out in this editorial and said that they were wrong. I believe it was posted yesterday. And they talked about Texas, where Texas was facing another $1 billion charge to build more prisons. And so what they did is they took the freedom approach and they applied freedom and liberty to the situation and said, you know what, let's get rid of mandatory minimums. So far, they've closed 3 prisons and several other facilities, and crime has dropped in Texas. So it works.
It does. It's fiscally conservative. You know, it's socially liberal, and then it's pragmatic at the same time. It should be a home run political position.
Right. So why isn't it?
Because of who the donor bases are to both parties.
Meaning old-timers?
Old white-haired people, and, right. You know, it's... Ugh. It's just the nature of the beast. And people are scared because the science is there, the emotional parts. It's all there. And Rand Paul came out and supported it, and Eric Holder supports it. My God.
Yeah. There's bipartisan support to actually get this done, but people don't want to see soft on crime. I mean, the war on drugs was created after Nixon got some bad polling results when he was president. And so he wanted to look tough on crime, so he started the war on drugs, appealing to the greatest quote unquote generation.
The silent majority?
Right.
Yeah.
And the silent majority. I think that's where that term comes from, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
All these damn hippie pothead kids out there with their rock and roll music needed something to run on re-election on, and so he ran on the war on drugs. And then, the Reagans get in, would just say no, and this is how it really ratchets up,
Yeah, it went crazy.
Oh, Nancy was hell-bent. Ronald, I don't know. I mean, he was head of the Actors Guild. He was an actor. I mean, my God, if he didn't smoke a joint,
I'd
be
stunned.
Yeah,
I'm sure he smoked some dudes.
And he was a former Democrat. He for sure smoked some pot.
Right.
And then, but Nancy just got in his head on that and just wouldn't let off it.
Yeah, so
I'm sure that there was a lucrative money making scheme somewhere in there.
It's the what was it from the newsroom? The American Foundation for Families of Foundational Family Values, or something like that. Probably donated $15 million.
Do you remember all of the advertising, the propaganda that they created for the Just Say No?
This is what your brain looks like on drugs.
Yeah,
right.
Tremendous amount of money
that's what it looks like after a police officer beats my head in with a baton.
The DARE programs in schools. Did you guys have DARE at your school? I know we did.
Oh, yeah.
Greg and I went to school together.
DARE to keep kids off drugs? Absolutely. I won the You'll get a kick out of this. I won the essay contest at the end of the year. You know, everybody writes an essay.
In support?
Of DARE.
Oh, talk about opposition research if she ever runs again as a libertarian.
I also smoked pot with my DARE officer.
Oh, please name him.
No, hell no. Are you kidding?
We had a female DARE officer.
Did you really?
Yeah, we did.
They told us about like these drinking parties. Like we're in middle school, sixth grade, these drinking parties that took place at this Hummel Park in Plainfield after school. And I'm like, where do you hang out and patrol? At Hummel Park, it's the most boring place on the planet.
So it's shown in schools that DARE schools have higher percentages of drug use.
Duh.
True fact.
So, I mean, during Prohibition, we had higher percentages of drinking. That's what happens when you take something away.
Knowledge
well,
is
I mean,
power,
think about turns. Think about schools that teach abstinence only and how many girls drop out pregnant. I mean.
Yep.
So the war on drugs, you know, ratcheted up with the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 86. Mandatory minimums were a part of it. They really cracked down on crack because, you know, crack is whack.
Crack is whack.
And that's what was taking place in the African American community. So
yeah.
you would get you know, for crack abuse you'd get for crack dealing you'd get the same level of punishment that you'd get for like murder and child rape. So
But of course powdered cocaine was exempted from that, much lower because that was the drug of choice of Gordon Gekko and the Wall Street King of the Universe, not the urban poor.
And that is essentially now we're seeing the rural poor.
Could you imagine if it was alcohol, though?
Oh,
like PBR, and you were going to jail for life.
Yep.
But if you had a Stella, you were going to walk. Everything
a
was
A DUI
cool.
on a $500 bottle of wine is an hour of community service. But if you're drinking Schlitz, it's 3 years in prison.
And that's, basically.
Yeah.
And now with meth, they're cracking down on meth, and you see the campaign to it's the scourge of the earth.
Yeah.
And, you know,
meth
is a dangerous drug.
I mean,
it is, of course. So is crack. So is, I mean, cocaine is dangerous.
Aaron Sorkin wrote the first three seasons of The West Wing on crack cocaine.
Really?
Yeah, he did. And that's why he got arrested and kicked off the show. But, like, I mean, so it's dangerous, but it's also a highly functioning thing.
You can write Greg's favorite
meth
TV show.
Meth pretty much kill you. If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, meth will ruin, like, your entire internal system.
Right.
Whereas crack cocaine's damaging to your teeth, but unless you abuse it hard, it won't kill you.
But if we had not cracked down on weed and then cracked down on cocaine and then cracked down on crack and then cracked down, would we be at meth at this point? Or because we just keep cracking down, you know,
there has to be a new designer drug.
Right.
There will always be drug use.
I mean,
always,
but I mean, it's a valid
forever.
Point because when they crack down and they confiscate and they take drug out of the free market system,
it's a market reaction.
Right. There's a new designer alternative is going to pop up.
And now it's those freaking bath salts that turn people into face eating zombies.
Crocodile is what's going on in Russia.
Crocodile.
You want to not sleep tonight? Google crocodile with a K. Their word for crocodile. I mean, this thing, it's horrific photos. So
it's only a matter of time.
You S&M types, take a look. So,
oh wow,
it's horrifying.
I'm
and
gonna have to do it now.
It's called the 4chan drug.
Yes. So you've got the ending of the mandatory minimums, and you've got, you know, pot legalization is really picking up steam. You know, you saw Chris Christie this week getting abused by. He's got a pot. A medical marijuana bill on his desk that he's got to make a decision on tomorrow. And he was confronted by a father of a daughter with a Gervais disease, which is an epilepsy disease that she could die from. And he asked her, why are you trying to kill my daughter by not authorizing this bill? And Chris Christie yelled at him to his face in Chris Christie fashion. You know, it's more complicated than that. I know you think you understand, but you don't. Which was a very compassionate moment for Chris Christie. But you have this movement moving across the nation. Do you think the war on drugs is close to being ended?
The tipping point has begun. I think a lot of it was, I think Gupta's article started it. You know, all the heavy lifting was done by Reason, libertarians. I mean, it really was.
Right.
Even Democrats didn't want to touch the issue except the ones who advocated it was racist.
Sanjay Gupta came out this week with his documentary Weed and said he was totally wrong about pot.
You talk about like a setting off point.
Right.
I think that's it. I think we're on the way down.
Crocodile, tell me how bad that is.
That's f***ing terrifying. That's like I've had a nightmare about something similar, and now you can't unsee it. Don't Google it, kids.
Yeah, it's bad.
It can't be unseen.
So, Edward Snowden, stay away from that stuff,
yeah,
buddy.
No kidding.
We know he's an avid listener of the show.
Yes, yes.
If you're, the NSA is listening to this, no, he's not. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think we're heading down that slope of the war on drugs. Gina, you are our enlightenment enhancement correspondent on the show. Do you feel that the war on drugs is coming to an end?
I feel like it's overdue to be ended. I feel like it's the never-ending prohibition. Like the never-ending
prohibition song. It just goes on and on.
And so, you know, as far as I'm concerned, somebody f***ed up in the 60s because we should have had this handled when normal started organizing. But then the surge in the 80s with the whole just say no wave. And now you have kids that are, you know, some of the younger generations coming up, you know, find out that their mom or dad smokes pot and they're like, oh, you're on drugs. We're going to be homeless. That's just the next step.
Yeah.
I've heard of it happening.
Pot, homelessness. There's a direct correlation.
Exactly. Exactly. And so it's kind of out of control, the response that, I guess the education that is being forced on some of our children right now is kind of extreme.
No, it's propaganda.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, again,
it is wrong information that is being used for behavioral to change behavior.
And I feel like there is an educational wave that's happening. I do feel like people are waking up. I do feel like people are realizing more and more that there is no evidence that suggests that getting rid of a God-created substance like a plant was a good idea. There's no medical evidence that of any kind on marijuana because they say it's too dangerous to test. Meanwhile, they test, you know, we've got studies on radiation, we've got studies on chemotherapy, we've got studies on, you know, this, that, and the other pharmaceutical.
Literally every substance.
Right. But it's too dangerous and unethical to run a test with marijuana.
God forbid you have, I mean, well, the only danger is that so it makes people even less engaged.
I mean, Gervais,
which would be hard to accomplish.
Yeah, Gervais' disease, it was a disease covered in the Sanjay Gupta documentary. I haven't watched it yet, but I saw a piece on Jake Tapper on his show today. This helps stop epilepsy. Marijuana helps stop epilepsy.
It has a ton, I mean, a ton of medicinal benefits.
Yeah.
And it's actually, the pharmaceutical companies are going to hate it.
If I'm not mistaken, Queen Victoria smoked for, like, PMS or something.
Really?
Yeah, I
really?
Remember reading that one time.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a joke there, but I can't get one
it's
out.
It's like
fast
my doll. My doll?
It's an inhalable my doll.
There you go.
Yeah.
Never inhale.
Never inhale.
Always inhale.
You know what's funny is I want to see how Bill Clinton flip-flops. if this gets legalized.
How quickly he admits to inhalation.
Remember DOMA. He signed DOMA. I was against that bill the whole time.
To be fair,
you know?
Bill Clinton, though, he's always had a misunderstanding about what the definition of is.
That's true.
So he struggles.
When I say inhale, I just mean I kept it in the whole time and never exhaled.
That's right. You know?
Oh, Slick Willie.
Yep.
That report, did you guys see the Clinton Foundation report?
Scam.
That his Clinton Foundation is basically just like his presidency. It's like all these shady connections and totally mismanaged and out of control. And
It is so hard to run a not-for-profit well, effectively, financially sound. I mean, it is damn near impossible anymore.
And you can't have somebody who ran the entire country running a
foundation. No, and he's not engaged. He's not engaged. He wants to make sure that his private jet's fueled and he can go and speak for $100,000 speaking fee.
Hey, honey.
Yeah, and then tell Hillary he loves her and go find some fresh.
Bill keeps
strange.
Strange.
He keeps calling me about my Ray-Bans.
Does he?
He wants the poonhound glasses.
Poonhound shades.
That's the poon shades, which my wife found my poon shades.
Yeah.
In the closet in there, and I was like, "Honey, don't you worry about that."
Yeah.
Don't you worry.
And then she said, "What are they?" And then I said, "Yeah."
I just see you. On, I see like a 70s porno scene happening, and you have on a fake, thick Selleck mustache.
Oh, yeah.
I put them on, and then I just kind of pulled it down to the bridge of my nose, and I said, "What do you think's about to happen?"
You're about to get three of the best minutes of your life.
Three. You're generous. Well, I think that should be the end of this show.
Oh,
I think it's a perfect place to wrap up.
Yep. So you can't get much better than my poonhounding days.
That's right.
Which didn't exist, trust me. I tried.
They did on several AOL chat rooms.
There was a lot of hounding.
Oh.
There was a lot of hounding, but there wasn't a lot of pooning. all right. So anything that we need to promote, anything that we need to wrap up with. Greg, at the end of the show, we like to give you an opportunity to speak your mind at the end of the week.
I think the next big news story is going to be a 60-day continuing resolution in Congress to fund the government's and probably give some sort of concession to the president so they can use the debt ceiling come November 1st to get a whole bunch of concessions for a budget. That would be the one thing I'd watch out for. I know it's kind of boring, but there you go.
Yep. Here it comes.
What should we watch out for? What you would you like to promote, dear Gina Bear?
Keep your eyes open for tax reform. It needs to make some progress. It's long overdue. What else? Oh, do listen to Storytime with Gina if you'd like. We'll be recording here in a second.
It will be highly offensive.
Yep.
Yeah, I promise to offend you.
Seriously.
Or try.
Like, if you ever want to vote for any one of us, don't listen to that.
Yeah,
at all.
No.
So, well,
you're not running ever, are you?
No.
Oh, God, me neither.
No. I'll run next week if you guys convince me.
I want to be a dictator. I have no interest in being a democratically elected leader.
I have talked hundreds of people into running for office.
It's
so
true.
I know how awful it is.
Yeah. Oh,
so,
God.
No, I really don't. I don't have that gene where I was going to say I don't have the gene where I like to talk about myself, but
that's
I guess
a lie.
I do.
How many
totally
podcasts
do
you run, manage,
yeah,
record
exactly
weekly?
A podcast is better when I'm
podcast,
on it.
I agree.
Podcast.
I'm just saying. It doesn't mean you don't like
what kind
to talk
of kitchen is that, Spangler?
Yeah, a podcast. What kind of kitchen is that? So, yeah, no, I don't ever want to run for office. Like, that's just too much, like, going out and knocking on doors. I'm an introvert at heart. Like, I really would just rather stay at home and watch TV.
I mean, I'll run for office, but I want you to know me as a human being and not as a talking head.
It's the filthy...
Trust me, the candidate version is way better. Way... No, just kidding.
Gina, like, until she joined this podcast and it became out, like, what a filthy human being she really is. Like, I was like, she is so well put together. She's so polished. It's... She's
I
amazing.
Generally am, but, you know.
And then she gets on the podcast. She's like, fart, oops.
She's a Valley Girl?
Yeah, that's how
I
she
farted
sounds.
And I Valley Girl giggled.
Apparently.
That's what happened.
Apparently.
I would like to once again promote the documentary, The House I Live In. I have no fiduciary duty in this podcast, in this documentary, but it just speaks to so many issues that we're dealing with right now. And mandatory minimums is covered in it and how it forces people to plead guilty to something that they didn't do. So The House I Live In, you can get it on YouTube, Netflix, in both ways. So please check it out and then share it. And speaking of share, we're up to over 400 subscriptions on this podcast.
Nice.
We have almost 700 people that listen to this show a week. You know, so we are way above tens and tens of listeners like we used to have.
And our
we
families
are 30s
aren't big
and 30s.
Either, so.
Well, I have a Catholic family, so that counts for 130 of the subscriptions.
Okay, all right.
I'm just kidding. My family doesn't listen to anything I do. So we just want to say thank you, and please keep spreading the word. If you like the podcast, please, please, please go to wearelibertarians.com, grab that URL, put it on your Facebook, and say, listen to these guys and gal. They inform me every week. They make me laugh, and then they tell me about cool and interesting things like crocodile.
Yep.
So,
yikes. Sorry about that, guys.
Yeah, don't look that up. All right, everybody, thank you. I felt that this was a good show. I felt that we said a lot.
Nice and tight.
It was very informative. Yeah. I think you learned a lot if you listened to the show, and that is not normal for us.
So it'll probably want to be one of the most less listened to.
Right.
So,
people do not like to learn.
I'm going to do the tagline, we promise next week to do worse.
Aww.
Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell.